Genesis, the early part, we're going to be looking at a couple of guys. The last couple times I talked about a year ago about working hard at this life, and then 6 months or so ago about the importance of corporate worship and participating in church activities and just the importance of corporate, just the church in general and how God set that up. And tonight I'm going to talk about faith in action. And after I kind of got done preparing, I was thinking, I'm talking a lot about things that we're supposed to do for in our Christian walk. And I'm not a works-oriented Christian, so maybe next time I'll have to talk on resting in the Lord or some of the aspects of stuff that he's done for us. But this is what God kind of laid on my heart tonight to share about. So we're going to be in Genesis chapter. We're going to start all the way back with Noah. So we'll be in Genesis chapter 7, primarily. We'll start in 6. So I did want to open in prayer before I get started, though. So let's bow our heads. Lord, thank you for tonight. I just thank you for the chance to share your word. I thank you for the chance to study your word. I thank you for what a gift it is to us. And I just pray that you would continue to give each of us just a hunger for it. I pray that we would apply it to our lives in every way we can, that we would just cherish it for the wonderful gift that it is. And we just thank you for the truth that is in it and for your spirit who is always looking to enlighten our eyes and open it up to us. And we pray that your spirit would be here tonight in our midst and do that just for us. Amen. All right, so it's kind of different teaching as a quote-unquote guest speaker because Sam doesn't tell me what to talk about. Normally when I teach in the jail, and we teach through the Gospel of John. And so the next time you go in, you just teach the next chapter. You never have to try to figure out what you're going to say. You have to just teach what chapter is next. So generally, when I'm teaching for something that isn't in sequence, it's a little more effort to try to come up with what to talk about. And so I think this is something that God's been kind of just working in my life on. And so hopefully it's something that's applicable to you guys and that you can benefit from it as well. And I know his word is always beneficial, so I trust that it will be. We are going to be going through quite a few verses. We're going to be doing a survey of Noah's life and then Adam's life and then looking at some application at the end. So there'll be quite a bit of time spent in Genesis and then a little bit in Hebrews. And primarily we're going to be focusing on how these guys lived out their response to God's calling in their life. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about how we know what God's telling us to do. I think if that's a question you have, Sam gave a really excellent message on that about a year and a half ago. And I know it's on the website, so I could help you find that if that's something that you'd like to hear if you weren't here for that. But Sam did a great job addressing kind of how to hear God's voice in our life and how to understand what his call is. But I'm going to try to focus on when we know what that is, what is our response to that? And I think Noah and Adam exemplified that in a lot of ways, a lot, in more than other characters in the Word. So I think I kind of picked them to look at tonight. So let's start in Genesis chapter 6. So prior to this, just to kind of give a little bit of background, this is about 1,500 years after the fall, when the flood happens. Noah was born about 1,000 years after the fall. And his father's name was Lamech. And we see in chapter 5, verse 29, or 28, it says, Lamech lived 182 years and begot a son. And he called his name Noah, saying, this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. After he begot Noah, Lamech lived 595 years and begot sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old, and Noah begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And we see that this guy names his son Noah, and he mentions the curse, and that he names his son Noah because this one will bring us comfort, or rest is what Noah means. And this one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed. And this is 1,000 years after the curse. And so this is still something that's in the forefront of his mind. And part of that is because they lived so long back then that Shem, or Seth, who was Abraham, or who was Adam's son, is still alive at this time. He was born when Adam was 180 or something like that. And so he was still around. And so they had a very clear understanding of the fall, and they had a very clear understanding of where they had come from, and probably knew really well the story of the Garden of Eden and what things were like before the curse. And as we read into chapter 6, you're going to see things have changed a lot in the last couple of chapters, in those 1,000 years. And man has become corrupt, and that the sin has really taken its hold on the world, and that curse that God promised as a result of sin is really evident in what's going on. So let's pick it up in verse 1. Now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his hearts was only evil continually. And just contrast that with what Adam and Eve had 1,000 years earlier before the fall. There was no evil at all. There was only righteousness. There was only that close relationship with God. They walked with God in the garden. They had it perfect. And because of sin, that was messed up. And now mankind as a whole is grieving the Lord because every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And then in verse 6, And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping things and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And aren't we thankful for those kind of buts in life? If it just was a period there and then went on and God destroyed the earth, where would we all be? But that wasn't the case. There was this guy who lived a righteous life. We see in verse 9 that Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. So in verse 8, why was it that Noah found grace in the eyes of God? It says, so the whole world is bent on evil. The whole world is turned away from God. All mankind is fallen. And yet Noah found grace in the eyes of God. How is that? Why is that? And I think it's because he was different from those who were in the world. He was set apart. He had a different mindset. He hadn't surrendered his heart to the things of sin and had kept his heart bent on things of God. And 2 Peter tells us that Noah was a preacher of righteousness in a very dark and dim time in our earth's history. He was a preacher of righteousness. And so for those reasons, he found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And God keyed into Noah and thought, this is the guy that I can start over with. This is the guy that I can destroy all other mankind and start fresh with him. And it records that he was a just man, perfect in his generations. And that doesn't mean that he was perfect without sin. And I don't fully understand how God's plan of salvation worked before the law, before Christ. Now it's very clear. You believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you are saved. And if you accept his atonement for our sins, it's paid for. Before Jesus was on the scene, when there was the law, that was kind of the pattern of salvation, was that you did your best to follow the law and do the sacrifices and the different commands that God had laid out for his people. But this is even before the law. So what salvation looked like and what the difference between someone who was saved and what someone who wasn't saved was really the way that they lived their life and their heart towards God, and whether they were living their life in rebellion towards God or living their life in harmony with God and trying to live their life as best they could, even in their fallen state, because they didn't have Jesus' conquering power over sin yet. But it was their heart towards God, and whether they had a soft heart towards him or not. And that's my understanding, that's my kind of belief in how things worked back then. And so we see that Noah had that he had that heart for God. And even with the different terrible things that were going on around him, he had a heart for the people around him, that he was preaching righteousness. He didn't just keep it for himself and his family. He was sharing that. And it didn't have any effect. He didn't have any fruit. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But he was faithful to that. And so then he has three kids. He has Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And at this point in his life, he's 500 years old. So he's lived a lot longer than any of us ever will, and seen a lot of corruption and a lot of just evil things going on in the world around him, and yet he's maintained his righteousness through that. And part of that was probably because of his heritage. His great-grandfather was Enoch, who was the guy who walked with God for 300 or some odd years, and then was not. God took him out of this world because he was a righteous man. And then Enoch's son, Methuselah, was his grandfather, and he was the one who God essentially promised that when this man dies, judgment will come. And Methuselah, there's some different ideas of what his name means. Some of the different theories are when he dies, judgment, or when he dies, it shall be sent, prophesying of the flood, or when he dies, and they get that from Hebrew for muth and shalak are two different Hebrew words. Muth means death, and shalak means to bring. So death or to send. So to bring death or to send death. And which is what happened when he died. The year that Methuselah died is the year that the flood happened, if you look at the genealogy, the record of the years. So these are his ancestors. These are people that were righteous, that served God. And it's kind of interesting because up until this point, everybody lived a really, really long time. And then all the righteous people, kind of God orchestrates it so they all die at the same time. And it's only Noah left and his family that make it through the flood. And so it kind of compresses the generations, which is unique. And then after this, Noah's sons live for a really long time. And they're alive for multiple generations after him. But at this little snapshot in time, God compressed it to save these individual people. And it was just two generations, the parents and the kids. And it's just kind of an interesting thing that if you look before this and after this, it's very different. And then after Abraham and his descendants, people started living more normal times of more like we do today. So Noah's living his life. He sees the evil that's going on in the world around him. And God speaks to him. Let's keep reading in verse 11. So then the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And I look around us today, and our earth is pretty corrupt, but it's not every single person. And imagine if every single person in the entire world was corrupt, and your family was the only one that was serving the Lord. That'd be rough. That would be a hard way to live. And that's the world that Noah lived in. And yet he maintained his relationship with the Lord. And the Lord noticed that. The Lord saw that. So in verse 13, then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth." Verse 14, "Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it a cubit above." So all these details about the ark. And then he says in verse 22, it records, "Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him." So he did. And so Noah's just living his life. He's lived for 500 years. He has three kids, and God speaks to him, "I'm going to be judging the world. I'm going to wipe the entire world out. And this is what I want you to do. I want you to make this huge boat and gather all the animals and birds and put them on the boat, and I'm going to save you and the world through this miraculous event." And that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible thing today to even think back on that it happened. But imagine if you were Noah and God told that to you. I'm not sure what I would think. I would think, am I really hearing God right? Or, and it doesn't say that he questioned God. It says, after God's finished speaking, it says, thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him to do. He had faith. He trusted that what God told him was true, that it was accurate, and he acted on that trust. He didn't just believe it intellectually, but he lived the next 100 years building this ark, which is a big deal. I mean, that's a huge, and we don't know if it was exactly 100 years. It says that he was 500 when he had his kids, and we don't know how old they were, but it seems like they were pretty young when God spoke to him about the ark. So somewhere between 70 and 100 years probably it took him to build this. And that's a long time to be working at something that God tells you to do and not see any evidence or signs that this doom and gloom that has been prophesied is coming. And the world all this time is still evil. It doesn't get more evil because it's completely evil to begin with. And yet he obeys. He follows God's lead, and he obeys right away. He doesn't procrastinate. And it's a big project for a man to do with his three kids, and I don't know if he had other help, but it took him a long time. So that's just an amazing thing to me, and just a good example of how to, when we hear God's call in our life, how to respond to it and how to act on it. So then the Lord said to Noah in verse 1 of chapter 7, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you 7 of every clean animal. It talks about the animals again. And then in verse 6, Noah was 600 years, or in verse 5, and Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him to do. And we see that said a couple of times, that Noah did. And it doesn't say that Noah did most of what God told him to do. It doesn't say that Noah did as best he could what God told him to do. He did everything. He obeyed God. All the details that God gave him, he did those and followed through with that. And then with his sons, his wife, his sons' wives, he goes into the ark because of the waters of the flood were coming. Brings the animals in. And there's an interesting statement in verse 13, I think, because God had told him, in verse 4, it says, for after 7 more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth. So God says, in a week, it's going to start raining. So get into the ark with the animals. And then in verse 13, on the very same day, Noah and Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons entered the ark. So he didn't wait the 7 days and wait for the animals to go on the ark first. He got on the ark first himself. And then it says the animals came to him in verse 9. Yeah. So that Noah was already on the ark when the animals were coming in. He's not herding the animals onto the ark. And I just thought that was interesting when I was looking at this, that he made sure he and his family were on the ark first. And that as soon as God told him, get on the ark, the flood's coming in 7 days, he didn't wait those 7 days. He got on the ark right away. And I was telling my kids, because I had noticed this, and a situation came up on Monday, and they were supposed to do something, and they were just dragging it out. And they weren't doing it when they were supposed to. And they knew they had a little bit of time, and I said, you know what? Noah, when God told him to get on the ark, he didn't wait the 7 days. He had 7 days. He probably could have, but God told him to get on the ark. He got on the ark right away. So when mom and dad tell you to do something, do it right now. And I think a lot of times when God calls us to do something in life, if it's not something urgent, if it's just something that he kind of puts on our minds, we think, yeah, that'd be cool. I should talk to that person at work about the Lord. And then we don't necessarily look for an opportunity to do that. We just think that'd be a good idea. But we don't act on it. We don't take action, and we don't follow through with what he's laid on our heart. And that's very easy to do, and it's easy to do all the time. And this is something, that's kind of what God's been trying to work in my life, is that when he prompts me to do something, hey, this new family's at church, you should have them over for dinner. Don't wait 6 months until they get comfortable. Invite them right away. And then they might still be here 6 months from now. And just those kind of things. Where why wait when God prompts us to do something? And Noah didn't wait. And I think it's good for us to act in the moment when God leads us to do something. So then they're on the ark for almost a year. And then picking it up in verse 1 of chapter 8. I need to catch up on my notes. I think I skipped a couple pages here. All right, so chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind pass over the earth, and the waters subsided." And imagine if you were Noah floating around on the water for almost a year. And I after a couple of months, I'd start wondering, when is this going to end? God had told him to gather food and stuff, so he had done that. But I mean, there's only a limited amount of food that you can fit on an ark, and they have all these animals to feed. And during that time, it doesn't seem that he wavered. It doesn't seem that he doubted God, and God remembered him. And it's not that God had forgotten him. But God remembered him, and the animals on the ark, and then starts drying up the water, and then the water starts subsiding. And so they get off the ark, and the first thing Noah does, God tells him in verse 16, "Go out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth." So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, every bird, and whatever creeps on the earth, according to their families, went out of the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled a soothing aroma. Then the Lord said in his heart, "I will never again curse the ground for man's sake, although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease." And Noah got to hear that promise after seeing this horrendous, and then God sets the rainbow in the sky as a symbol of this, that he's not going to curse the earth again. And after Noah, I don't know how many people Noah knew outside of his family, but everyone he knew for 500 years was killed, was killed in that judgment. And he was starting over. He and his family were the only living people on earth. And that's a hard thing too. When you're 600 years old and you're starting fresh, the earth is completely decimated. It's been underwater for a year. I mean, there's trees are just now starting to sprout and come back to life. And it's got to be just a mess. And yet God gives him this promise. And that must have been encouragement to Noah, I think, after seeing all this judgment, that this isn't going to happen again. This is the last time that God's going to do this. And my great 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 grandkids aren't going to have to go through this. That this is a one time event in history, and God makes that promise to him. And one of the first things he does is builds an altar to the Lord and worships him. I just think that's important as well. So Noah's just an interesting character, and he's not perfect. He plants a vineyard and gets drunk and does some weird stuff after this. So he's not completely perfect. He's a sinner just like the rest of us, but he did have an amazing faith, and he had an amazing faith that he acted on, that he relied on, and didn't question what God had commanded him to do and had called him to do. So let's fast forward in time a little bit and go over to Genesis chapter 12. We pick it up, and so There's this guy, Terah, and he has a son when he's 70 years old, and he names him Abram, and that's who this individual is. And they're a descendant of Shem. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Shem is still alive at this time, which is kind of interesting. A lot of people don't realize that Shem lived all the way up until Isaac was born. Isaac was about 50 when Shem died, so that because people lived so long, the stories of the flood and the stories of what God did in the garden, it wasn't that many generations before it got to Moses. And so that's why I believe we can have utter confidence in the things that Moses recorded. It it was a long period of time, but the stories wouldn't have gone through that many people necessarily, because all these people in for the first couple thousand years lived a really, really long time. So it was word of mouth, and it was only through about four generations before it would have got to Moses. So, but anyways, there was this guy named Terah, and he had a son named Abram, and God speaks to Abram in verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord had said to Abram, 'Get out of your country, from your kindred and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be blessed. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.' So Abraham departed." So we don't know much about Abraham or Abram, and if I mess him up and call him Abram or Abraham, his name doesn't change until chapter 18. So if I call him Abraham, no, his name's Abram until chapter 18. But most of us think of him as Abraham because that's what he ended up being. But anyways, Abram was 75 years old, and God speaks to him and calls him out of his homeland. And at this point, he didn't have any kids. He was married to his cousin, Sarah, or Sarai. And God calls him out of his homeland to a land that he will show him, doesn't tell him where it's going to be, just calls him out to go find it. And then he tells him that, "I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great." And that was probably an encouragement to Abram, because up until this time, he didn't have any kids. And if you look at the previous generations, except for his dad had him when he was 70, but the eight generations before that, every single one of them had their first kid when they were between 29 and 35 years old. So not too different from our population today, that you have kids fairly young because that's when you have the energy to raise them. But Abram was 70 and he didn't have any kids yet. His wife was barren. And yet God, he was 75. And God promises to make him a great nation. And that was probably exciting for him. He thought, well, I'm not totally too old yet. This can still happen. And then God says, "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So God gives him this promise. And we don't see Abram sitting at home waiting for God to show him where to go. The next verse, "So Abraham departed." Doesn't know where he's going, but he knows God told me to leave here and to go find this land which he's going to show me. So I better leave here and go find the land that he's going to show me. And this is also a hard thing. He leaves his family behind. He leaves everything that he's comfortable with, that he knows, that's familiar to him. And he's 70 years old. So this isn't, he's not a young guy getting started in his life. He's a mature guy. And that's a big step of faith, to uproot everything that you have and to go to a different place that you don't know where it's going to be. But he didn't waver at that. He went right away. And Abram has a few more trip-ups than Noah does as he goes. His faith kind of went up and down. We're going to mostly look at the highlights, but there are some spots where he doubts and he lies about who his wife is because he's afraid that people are going to kill him because she's so beautiful. But for the most part, he trusts God for what God's called him to do. So that's when he leaves. And then in Genesis chapter 12, verse 7, God reiterates the promise. He says, "Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.'" So after he gets to Canaan, so he's traveling around and he stops in Canaan and God appears to him and speaks to him. So tells him essentially, "I will give you this land. This is the land, you've made it. You've gotten to where you're supposed to go." So he builds an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him. And then he moves from there to the mountains east of Bethel. And he pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. So Abram journeyed going on still towards the south. So he's still traveling around in the general vicinity. And everywhere we go, we see this all through these next five chapters. Everywhere he stops and makes a camp, he builds an altar first thing and worships God and makes a sacrifice. And I think that vouches for his character and that he's not just some guy that God picked from random, from anybody living, that this was a guy who was following the Lord, and that's why God called him out. And that's why God called him out and why he picked this guy to have his descendants be the people of Israel and be his chosen people. So he travels around in chapter 15, or actually chapter 13, verse 14. It says, "And then the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him." So if you remember, they were in an area and the land couldn't support all their flocks and herds. And so Abram tells Lot, "Well, you pick an area and I'll pick the part that you don't choose." And so Lot picks the valley down by Sodom and Gomorrah. And then after Lot leaves, the Lord speaks to Abraham here in verse 14. "And the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot had separated from him, lift your eyes now and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward." And that's every direction, right? There's not a different word than those words. "For all the land which you see, I give to you and your descendants forever. And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered." So at this point, God pretty much shows Abraham, all this land that you see is what I've given you and your descendants. And there's cities and there's kings that rule different areas, but God's promise and told Abram, this is what that part of the promise is. And it was a two-part promise. Leave your land and find the land that I will show you. And so here God shows them explicitly, this is where you're supposed to be. And so Abram got the first part of the promise. But the second part of the promise, "I will make you great and I will bless you," hasn't happened yet, because he still doesn't have any descendants. He doesn't have any kids. But God reaffirms that promise in his life. In verse 16, "And I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants also could be numbered. Arise, walk in the land through its length and its width, for I give it to you." Then Abram moved his tent and went and dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and built an altar there to the Lord. And so, again, he doesn't question the Lord. He accepts that this land is his. And when God tells him to walk through it, he arises, he leaves, and he goes and camps somewhere else. He doesn't stay put. And just everything God tells him to do, he just goes and does it. He doesn't ask why. He doesn't question it. He just obeys. And he submits. And then Lot gets into some trouble, gets captive. Taken captive by some kings, and Abram rescues him with his 300 servants. And then in chapter 15, God reaffirms his covenant with Abram. In verse, really, the whole chapter is about the covenant. We won't read through it. But in verse 17, it says, so God reaffirms the covenant, and then he kind of puts Abram in a trance and does this sacrifice ritual with him. And it, verse 17, "And it came to pass when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there was a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces." So God had told Abraham to split these animals and a bull, a goat, a pigeon, and put them on two halves. And then the smoking torch and the oven passed between them. And that was the sign of God's covenant. And God put Abram in a trance for that, because the covenant wasn't based on what Abram was doing. And normally in those days when a covenant would be sworn into, it was each person would have the part that they had to uphold, that they were responsible for this and the other guy was responsible for this. And in this case, God makes a covenant with Abram, but God is the oven and God is the torch walking through those sacrifices. And so it's not contingent on what Abram does. Is completely independent of that. And then he says in verse 18, "To your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates." So reaffirming, and still he doesn't have descendants yet, but that he's going to. And so Abram, at this point, about 11 years have gone by, and he thinks, well, I'm not getting any younger, and Sarah's not getting any younger, and God's given me the land, and I know what that is, but I don't have the descendant yet. So God told me in chapter 15 that this one, in verse 4, God says, "This one shall not be your heir," speaking of his servant, because Abram wasn't sure if his servant was maybe the guy. "But it will be someone that comes from your own body." And Abram thinks, well, maybe if I have Sarah's servant girl and and I have a kid with her, maybe that'll fulfill the promise. And so they concoct this plan, and he has a son, Ishmael, with Hagar. And in his mind, this is the son that God's promised. This is the heir that he's promised. And so he believes that the covenant is fulfilled. And it's not. Little does he know that 13 more years go by after chapter 6 when he does this. Doesn't tell us what he does during that time, but probably just living the life and thinking that he's fulfilled, that he's got God's plan for his life figured out, and that he's where it's at. And then God speaks to him in chapter 17 and makes it clear that, no, this isn't the son. And Abraham says in verse 18 of chapter 17, and Abraham said to God, when God tells him that Sarah is going to have a child, "Oh, that Ishmael may live before you." Because this is what he's been living the last 13 years. He thinks that Ishmael is the chosen one. Then God said, "No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him." And so God reaffirms that what you've done isn't quite right. You have to wait a little longer. And then God appears to them in physical form before the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. There's an angel, or three angels, that come, and they promise that Sarah will have a child in a year. And she laughs at that, and Abraham believes, and it happens. It comes to pass. And so then he has the son of promise. He has the son of promise that he's been waiting for so long. And more time goes by. And he's living thinking that now I really do have. I have the son from Sarah. I have the land. The nations of the earth are going to be blessed through me. This is great. And we don't know how much time goes by, but then God speaks to him again and shakes his world up and wants to test him and wants to see if he's still the man that trusted him and followed him. So jumping all the way forward into chapter 22. It says, "Now it came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, 'Abraham,' and he said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you.'" And if you are Abraham, and you've been living 15, 20 years with this promised child, I would seriously question what I was just hearing from God. I would wonder, no, that can't be. He must be talking about Ishmael, maybe. That he's the son that I screwed up, and I shouldn't have done that, so maybe I'm supposed to sacrifice him and keep Isaac. Or any number of things could come into your mind. But it would be very hard to act on this statement from God. Because this is what God's promised. God's promised that I have this son. And now he's well over 100, because Isaac's a young man. And God tells him to sacrifice his only son, the son of promise. And so Abraham arose early in the morning, the next day. He doesn't even sleep in. He arises early. That's crazy. And I don't know how you could do that. And I don't know. I can't really put myself in that position to know what I would do, but I have a hard time believing that I would have the confidence in what God was telling me, and the trust and the faith in what God was telling me, to trust it explicitly in something like that. That was so contrary to everything that I understood in my mind. And I think it's so clear how we don't understand what God is doing in a lot of different situations. And a lot of times we try to second guess and try to understand what he's doing, and we think we understand what he's doing, and so we read into that. And a lot of times we don't. He's working in mysterious ways that we don't understand. And Abraham at this point, his name's been changed, doesn't question that. He gets up early the very next day, saddles his donkey, takes two young men with him and Isaac his son. He split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place which God had told him. And a huge picture of his faith is that he doesn't bring a backup plan. He doesn't bring an animal with him. He doesn't bring a secondary option just in case God changes his mind. And I think I would do that at least. Even if I left the house with my son, I would probably bring something just in case God wants to make sure that, yeah, you left, but okay, here, sacrifice the sheep instead that you brought. And he doesn't do that. He just leaves with his son, brings the wood, brings the fire, and his son keys into this. And he says, Dad, where's the sacrifice? And Abram tells him in verse 8, my son, God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering. And the two of them went on together. And he had utter faith that God would provide. And he didn't know what that was going to be, but he didn't question it. He didn't tell his son, I don't know, this is scary. I'm not sure what's going on. I mean, he just relayed his faith and imparted that faith that he had to his son and was utterly confident. Even to the point where he builds an altar, puts the wood on it, binds his son, puts his son on the altar, and he's ready to slay his son. All the way to the very, very bitter end. And he doesn't turn back. He doesn't second guess it. And I don't know if he thought that God would raise his Isaac from the dead or if he would give him another son afterwards. I don't know what was going through his mind, but he didn't question the command and the call that God had put on his life. He followed it and he acted on it. And that's an amazing thing. And right at the last minute, God tells him to stop. And God shows him a ram caught in the thickets with its thorns in its horns and thorns. And then God tells him in verse 18, in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. And this is a crystal clear picture of God's sacrifice of his son for us. And God didn't make Abraham go through with this. But this is exactly what God did for us, that he sacrificed the son of promise for us. And that picture would have been screwed up if Abraham had not obeyed. And God tells him that in your seed, speaking of Jesus, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. And that is so true. That Abram kept this picture clear because of his obedience. And it was a foretelling of what Jesus was going to do for us. And Moses had a similar opportunity to live something like this out, where he had the rocks where God was going to give water to the people of Israel out of the rocks. And the first time, God told him to strike the rock, and he struck the rock. The second time, God told him to speak to the rock, because God only struck his son once. He didn't have to be sacrificed twice. And Moses didn't listen. He didn't obey. He was mad with the people, and he struck the rock. And he messed up the illustration that God wanted to show. And because of that, he didn't get to go into the promised land. He was not blessed because of that, because of a simple act of disobedience. And it's so clear when you see these kind of stories and these people living their lives, the importance that God places on obedience. And God desires obedience more than sacrifice, he tells us. It's paramount in God's kingdom, is that we heed him and that we listen to him and that we follow his call in our life. And it's just really cool to look at people like Abram and Noah and see how they lived their life, how they didn't question what God did, and what God did through them because of that. Because Noah obeyed, mankind was saved. If Noah hadn't obeyed, think if he had decided to start building the ark 30 years later. He wouldn't have got it done in time. He would have been bent there with a half-built ship, and the flood came. And, I mean, God would have come up with a different plan, but it wouldn't have been through Noah, and he would have missed out on that. And just so many different things where if they hadn't followed through, when they did, when God told them to do something, it totally would have changed history, and it totally would have changed the way the people of Israel, their history, and just these different pictures that God put in the Old Testament for us to see that pointed forward to the way that we are to live our lives. So what does this mean to us? What's our response to this? How can we live our lives in the same way? And I came up with five different points. And for Sam's sake, I didn't use all the same letters like he usually does. I left that for Sam. But I did do an A, B, C, D, E. So if you're trying to remember, I did do that just for fun. But the first is to act on God's direction in your life. If you feel that God's calling you to do something, do it. And it's something that might sound really simple, but it's something that we don't always do. That we think, we hear God calling us to do something, and we think, that'd be cool. That'd be cool if God used me in that way. But we don't take the action necessary to see God use us in that way. And it would be cool. We're right. It would be cool. But we have to take that step of faith, of leaving our homeland, or leaving, starting this project that Noah had to do. Or just going to have some friends that felt called to leave Washington, and he got a job all the way across the country. They didn't have any family over there, and they moved, and as soon as they got there, their son was diagnosed with this terminal brain tumor, and turns out that the world-leading brain tumor pediatrician is right where they're at, and they moved across the country in his backyard. And it's been a year and a half, and he was given 4 months to live, and he's still alive and not doing great, but he's hanging in there, and they've just been able to have more time with him and a lot better chance of success in his life because they relocated. And they would have been here, and we have great hospitals around here, but this is a very specialized tumor, and it's the only guy who's really doing that work. And they don't have to move later to go to where he's at. They were already there. So they had a church set up. They have a support family around them. And just because they left, something simple like that, they acted on what God was calling them to do. So act is the first. And then second is be faithful. Be faithful in the little things. And I think both these guys, Noah and Abraham, weren't faithful after God called them to do these big things. Noah lived his life for 500 years before God told him to build the ark. And he didn't live a pagan life like the people in the world during that time. And if he had, God wouldn't have called him to build the ark, right? God would have found somebody else. And if we aren't faithful in the little things, God's not going to give us the big things. And that's an important thing. Same with Abram, that he lived 70 years and then God called him out. And I believe during that time, he was following the Lord with his life. And it wasn't some change that happened because God all of a sudden gave him this promise of a land and descendants and stuff. It was something that he was following the Lord with his life in the little things in everyday life, and then God called him out of that and used him because of that. Third thing is confidence in God's voice in your life. Don't question what God's telling you to do. And again, that message that Sam gave on hearing the voice of God would be good to go back and listen to in light of kind of this topic. And I think a lot of times we do question what God's telling us to do. We lack confidence and the faith to act and take the steps that we need to follow through. And then fourth is doing. Keep doing the last thing that you were told to do by God. Noah built the ark for a long time before the flood came. He didn't stop and wait for God to tell him what to do next. Abraham faltered because he didn't keep doing the things that God told him to do. He tried to short-circuit God's plan a little bit and had Ishmael and stuff as a result. And God might call you to do something and then not tell you to do something else for 20 years. But maybe he wants you to still be doing that thing that he told you to do the first time. And I know I've been teaching in the jails for almost 12 years now, and it's great. I love it. And it's a ministry that I'm comfortable with. It's something that I believe God is using in those guys' lives, and it's something I don't have any plans of ever stopping unless God called me to do something else explicitly. And he hasn't told me in my mind to keep doing that, but I felt called to do it when I started, and so I'm still doing it. And I think we miss out on some of the lasting effect of being able to serve God long term when we jump from thing to thing to thing and try to find the next thing that God's doing, maybe in different churches. Or I think there's some value in long-term ministry. And I talked a little bit about that when I was talking about being involved in the church, that if we bounce around too much, we miss out on seeing some of the long-term fruit that that God gives us when we serve him long term. And then fifth E is enjoying the harvest we get to participate in. And I look at these guys' lives, and Noah in particular, if he was a preacher of righteousness, and that was recorded in Hebrews, so we know it was true, and that's in the Hall of Faith, Hebrews chapter 11, that's in 2 Peter that it tells us that he was a preacher of righteousness. But he's recorded in the Hall of Faith, and so we know that his life was a life of faith, and so he was probably preaching for 600 years before the flood. And his wife gets to go on the boat with him, and his three kids and their wives. That would be discouraging. If you're preaching righteousness for 600 years and you don't have a single convert, a single person to take on the boat, the rescue boat with you, and everyone perishes, that's hard. And we don't live in that world. We see fruit around us all the time. Just in this church, there's been 5 or 6 people that have raised their hands this year at the end of service, given their lives to the Lord. In jail, there's been 3 or 4 guys this year. And we see people come to the Lord and get their lives changed and him working in their lives and the fruit that's comes from that. And working out the Union Gospel Mission and see guys coming off the street and getting into the drug and alcohol recovery program and getting to go to the graduation ceremony a year later and see what God's done in their life. There is so much fruit that God is doing around us. And I think it's important just to look at that and realize that and just enjoy that and realize what an amazing and awesome God we serve, that who loves us so much and wants to work through us and wants to use us and wants to be a part of our life. And we could have been born in a time like Noah when the world is evil only and there's no change and it doesn't change. And we continue bringing the same message, and it doesn't have any effect. And people just have blind eyes and stopped ears. But that's not the world we live in. Some people do, but a lot of people don't. A lot of people respond to the message of the gospel. And that's exciting to me. And that's a great thing. So act on his direction in your life. Be faithful in the little things. Have confidence in God's voice in your life. Keep doing the things that he's called you to do. And then enjoy the harvest that we get to participate in.